Welcome to the Aphorist. It is Saturday, 1:26. We are in Montalvo, art residency. This is Aphorist number one, Jesse Holding, with Aphorist number two, Anthony Ryan. And joining us today is our Susan O'Malley, Christine Wong Yap, and Leia
Rosenberg.
Thank you.
But do you prefer Leah?
Oh, Leah?
Yeah, okay. It's fine. Yeah.
Leah?
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't usually correct people just because it's, you know. It just could be an accent.
Really, yeah. So we just had a chance to visit your recent show, and the title of the show is Happiness is that correct? And heard you all speak about your work, which was really interesting, and then joining you was Carol
Petrovsky,
who is a happiness researcher at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And so, first of all, thank you for joining us, the Aphorists.
Thanks for having us.
One of the things that struck me about what Carol said was that there is not a strong sense of language around happiness research right now. And or that it's a nascent field, and that the ways of describing the study is just becoming more concrete, I guess. She said something like it's a seed, she had a nice way of talking about it, that talked about it just being in its sort of infancy as a discipline. And I was struck about this idea of language and the fact that, well, specifically Christine and Susan use language as a main component of your work. I think you talked a lot about, Leah, I'll try to get that, about visual, like the language of color. So I thought that was an interesting place to start, talking about the ways the work is unified. And my first question is, how do you expect your work to operate? And I think it's an age-old question about, especially when you're using text in work, one of the things that struck me is your expectation, first of all, what expectations do you have, and then how do you walk the line of sort of a didactic, of the possibility of being didactic, which would be something to navigate. So if that's an open-ended enough question to get this thing started, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to start?
So how do I navigate how people will kind of respond to the work? I mean, yes. I think actually Christine responded to that really interestingly in the talk, was that, that's part of the work is that as a viewer, you set up a situation as an artist, you kind of put your intention out there, but as a viewer, you can, choose which direction you want to go in terms of the interpretation of the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in terms of how people are going to respond to it. But then what the intention is, I think, for me, is to create an interruption in people's lives using these texts. And then using familiar ways of presenting the text, like signage or... in the case of the trails along, or the signs along the trail, it's sort of typical nature trail signage that feels familiar, and yet the language is going to kind of feel quite different. Maybe it's a little more poetic, or maybe it's something that you see a quote, on a calendar or something like that. It's a different language than something that would necessarily be in an advertisement, and so hopefully it creates a pause or a shift in one's experience in reading that, so that they're able to kind of center themselves or be mindful of whatever is in front of them, or internalize the text in their own ways of thinking or interpreting it for them, for their own selves.
Right.
So that's the way that I tend to think about, both kind of what I'm putting out there, and then also how someone might receive kind of what is out there as well.
It's interesting because there's you have this idea of an aphorism in our what we think about it. So it's a statement of fact or opinion, short, and you could view. I thought it was great. Like, wow, it's our first aphorist coming onto the aphorists. there's an impulse to be directive in the kinds of signage that you see that I think you're responding to. And I think maybe the better way to ask this question is, I find it interesting that I don't feel sort of preached to by your work.
Oh, that's
either
nice.
Any of your work. Mm-hmm. Which is striking to me because there's that sort of commanding, you know, text read in a certain kind of environment is commanding.
Absolutely.
And so I guess one question is, how do you choose what you're going to say? And do you think a lot about just the, it's like, there's some nitty gritty questions, mm-hmm. like about font sizes and fonts, mm-hmm. and I think those are important. I'm less interested in those. I mean, I can see how they operate more clearly, but maybe how you choose what you're saying.
I think a lot of the, well, for the walk especially, I think a lot of the things that I was thinking about were like related to mindfulness and mindfulness meditation and sort mm-hmm. of a lot of the mantras that I actually mm-hmm. use in mm-hmm. my daily practice. So I think a lot of that was coming from that personal experience and then trying to create like a rhythm mm-hmm. Along the walk as well. So that's sort of where the language was coming from there. And then I repeated some of the same ideas on the pillows in that space mm-hmm. as well. So, it really just comes, it's a little bit more, for me, it's the language is a lot more intuitive. Mm-hmm. It's kind of coming from a place of my own practice of mindfulness mm-hmm. And the things, the text that I read related to that.
Right.
Which
but
often
it's sort of like the opposite of advertising in a way, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you think like about another, I mean, Jenny Holzer called her phrase is aphorisms, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I started reflecting on her work, mm-hmm. looking at your work, mm-hmm. and like, I don't know if you've thought about that, but or that relationship, but like I wanted to ask like all three of you about just the notion of earnestness, which mm-hmm. seems like really mm-hmm. central
mm-hmm.
and like if I like just to enter that, like if I contrast Jenny Holzer's aphorisms, which of course I haven't thought about in a really long
yeah,
time
yeah definitely.
But if you reflect on the way she's crafting those aphorisms, they're often multi-layered
mm-hmm.
and quite often ironic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of ambiguity there
mm-hmm.
and a lot of space for different interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are straight up earnest. Some of them are completely ironic. And,
totally.
And so like, I feel like in all three of your work, maybe there is sort of, there's almost a reaction against that kind of coolness
mm-hmm.
of, you know, of that kind of work, like Jenny Holzer's work,
mm-hmm.
or even just like Leah, you're kind of quoting this like minimalist vocabulary in your work, you know, whether it's like Dan Flavin or, you know, that kind of
yeah.
stuff. And like, there's a coolness to that work that you also seem to be like in dialogue with. So I don't, maybe we'll bounce that to you.
Well, yeah, because I mean, I was kind of thinking about text, and we had had a conversation at the beginning, like at the very beginning when we were starting to talk about what we were going to show, and Donna had approached me with this series that I had done that was all text-based and stripes, so like excerpts from horoscopes from the Saskatoon Star Phoenix, which is a paper from where I grew up, and that was like a project that I did right out of school because I had a tiny studio, and it was like a daily kind of like a meditative thing where it was like a daily text with paired with a stripe, and so and those were all sort of hopeful, like or something I wanted to be reminded of. So it was a little bit like therapy after school, or like, but also for people that I a text would make me think of someone, so I would select it. But then we had a discussion like, well, what would it look like without text, or like with how do you sort of exude happiness without using text, or that we didn't all use text, mm-hmm. that wasn't like really the theme, because mm-hmm. I think that it's easy, like text is complicated, but it's also accessible, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. You know, signage is used because it's like you can fit a lot of information mm-hmm. in a few words, and people know what to do, but maybe. Maybe there's like alternative ways, and so I just really started thinking about different things not using text mm-hmm. As a balance, I guess, too. Mm-hmm. And in terms of like the Dan Flavin thing, I do, you know, one of the neons is blank, and the other one is, or colored stripes, and the other one is coated in gray, mm-hmm. so it backlits, which is like a Glenn Ligon kind of reference mm-hmm. that Christine made me aware of, and I like
which
things,
uses text, actually.
Which uses yeah. text, yeah. So I like that it's always connected, and maybe that's where like the like a little bit of a sense of humor comes in. Like sit down with the neon, and it's not, you know, and it's just supposed to make you happy. Mm-hmm. You know that it's actually like a function, a functional or utilitarian artwork, I think, is sort of, you know, and I was thinking about artists who've done neon, and most of them are men, which doesn't, I mean, wasn't the reason I did it, but I just, it's maybe the reason I decided to go through with it. did that answer your question?
Well, as far as text goes, I just, it made me think of, like, the drawing that I did called Positive Signs, United Theories, that's in the show, there's like a bunch of different writers' research folded into a big Venn diagram. But I also had like three little aphorisms in the top that I felt like were good to keep in mind. And one of them was that the goal of positive psychology is to describe rather than prescribe what people do to attain happiness. So I think a lot of the works that don't have texts, I think, are describing mm-hmm. ways of talking or thinking about happiness. And then there are works that do use text, and those are more prescriptive. But they're mm-hmm. very open-ended in how you go about enacting mm-hmm. them. So like Your Pillow, say talk and listen. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say what to talk about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say what to listen to, like mm-hmm. a person or just the sounds and the trail or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then my texts say, like, take charge of your happiness. It doesn't say how does it go about it, mm-hmm. but it just says that not to sit around and wait for it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one that says, what have I added to the wealth of creation? Which is a question.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is that, are either of those quotes, or are they?
Well, the second one is, it's mm-hmm. from William Blake. Mm-hmm. And for me, I wanted to pose, you know, take charge of your happiness is very simple, and I think you can apply it in very elemental ways. And then I think probably the most complex thing to tackle in like trying to find happiness is finding meaning in your life or finding a purpose. Mm-hmm. And I think that quote is my way of trying to get at like considering what you're glad for, what makes life worth living, what you're here for. Mm-hmm.
Do you find that, and I think this ties back to what you were talking about, earnestness, that there is, and I have a different school of thought about this, but the sort of like, there seems to be an intellectualism, a way of talking from an intellectual standpoint about art in general. Mm-hmm. And that as soon as you start talking about an emotional response, there's a dismissal of it, mm-hmm. sort of out of hand, that mm-hmm. says, you know, it maybe that's okay to have that feeling, but like it's too embarrassing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I reject that and say that we as artists need to come up with a language that is not, I think that there's a sort of like it's like, is this Southern Californian, you know, Earth, Moon, God, I don't know, whatever that sort of like hippie,
new
transcendental, new agey discussion there's another way to talk about an emotional response to either art making or art viewing. And I would say that you're doing, I've been very interested in that, and I like worked, did a year as with an American Psychoanalytic Institute as a fellow, and it was very enlightening. And when I tried to talk about this stuff with other artists, they were just sort of like looked at me the same way. And I say, you know, I feel like we need a language to talk about emotional responses to either making or viewing. And I see this, you know, so this idea of happiness is tied into that. And I feel like people would cringe at some of the things that you guys talked about. But and so I guess maybe that's a question, like how do you think, you said something very nice, which is I'm skeptical of the skepticism.
Yeah, right? I like that.
About sentimentality, right? So or maybe you could talk a little bit of sentiment, right? Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
There's like a quote by G.K. Chesterton that I heard on the radio, and it was just like, the meanest habit of humankind is to be skeptical of sentiment. And I looked up G.K. Chesterton, and he was a gift card. He was a greeting card writer.
That's so great.
But I think it is really true. It's like, what a terrible thing that if someone is like especially exuberant or really delighted to see you, that you think there's an ulterior motive or that they're simpleton or something. That, you know, it's like...
Right.
But I totally agree. Like, in more academicized, like, areas of art, people associate... like the avant-garde with opposition, with like radicality, and then it's such a negative thing. It's like a purely oppositional stance, which I think is like that. Like the idea with positive psychology is to not have to just be in opposition to stuff or to be. We had talked a little bit about Barbara Ehrenreich. I don't know if I'm saying her name, but that was just such when she came out with that book, that was. Trying to like take down positive psychology because her experience was like it didn't work for her, and then she thinks it's like related to all this like overly optimistic thinking in the markets and stuff. Was such a it was like such a oh God, first it was just a bummer and then it was just I think it was like totally missing the point of trying to do something that isn't just this oppositional thing.
Well, I think that there's an interesting, maybe a distinction, and I think Donna talked about The Antidote by Oliver Berkman in the talk, and then also, and then Barbara, I don't know, whatever her name is.
I think you're both saying it right.
Yeah. So the
Iron whatever.
So the question, so my reading of both of them, and more of Barbara Ehrlichman, Barbara, we'll just call her.
Yeah, you really butchered it.
Barbara E.
Is that there is a...
It makes me happy to hear her bitch about positivity, I have to say.
Right. Well,
just because she's fun.
Because... well, but there's a... But I think that there's a subtle distinction that needs to be made here. And one, it is that the... To be mindlessly rah-rah is different than being... that there's a possibility of having some self... There's a way of being deeper about it, I guess is what I'm saying. And so that there's a sort of facile, just be positive and everything will be all right. And yeah, that's I would react negatively to that too. That's not what you're saying at all. That's
well,
not
I,
what
didn't Carol use a term? It was like learned
optimism versus greed.
Oh, learned optimism.
Yeah.
Right. Like there's a difference between learned optimism and greed. Like
and
the
people would even distinguish between like learned optimism and hope.
Well, I think it's sort of interesting, like, maybe there's a way to kind of, like, in that same way that, you know, there isn't a developed language around kind of these ideas, like, people conflate, like, positive thinking with positive psychology and, like, the ways that you can learn optimism and you can actually physically, or you can actually change the chemistry in your brain using these ways of kind of... you know, approaching life, if there's ways in which that, you know, your question about, are there ways that we can bring this to the way that we look at art? And, you know, so there's ways that, you know, within an academic institution or any sort of art institution, there's ways of having a conversation about artworks that isn't, you know, so having to be so deeply critical or intellectual, that that numbs kind of the part of you that is about like the flow and about like kind of the love, I guess, of why we're all kind of here and interested in pursuing this field, you know.
I think your point about earnestness is really interesting, because a while back I had asked, like I had posted something like asking people to respond to like, when you're viewing a work of art, like what, how do you go about interpreting whether it's earnest or like how do you decide to trust or be skeptical of an object, right? And then I think some of the responses, I know you responded, and some of the stuff was about like whether the artist was earnest or not. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about like the courage that is required, like on the artist's part to put something into the work, but then also from the viewer's like reaction to like trust that like investing their attention is worth it, that there will be a payoff for them.
And to trust their own reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't sense that it's like sort of the prescribed reaction or the artist's intended reaction.
Right.
Yeah, I think like, I was thinking a lot about, because we briefly in the email exchange we were talking about like, you know, I think you were expecting I might play the role of the skeptic here.
Oh, yeah. Well, like, yeah, I mean.
And I think like, I feel that sometimes. I just wanted to back up a little bit to the Barbara Einreich thing, and like, just because I think there is skepticism around sort of this kind of, you know, of course, around like, you know, sort of, what are we broadly terming it? Positivity?
Like positive, or like thinking.
Positive,
I think.
Thinking. Because there is like, you know, there is, you know, rightly so, some skepticism towards like a lot of the self-help movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because like some of it is just like straight up hucksterism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like,
totally.
Which is not so much to like malign like, you know, positive thinking per se, but like, I think people's, you know, people's skepticism is maybe about when it veers into, you know, sort of hucksterism or...
Do you think it's hucksterism, or do you think it's just a lack of, like, we don't know what makes us happy? And that, so, like, this is just another stab at getting there.
Maybe it's because it can be so easily considered hypocritical. You know, for like someone to get rich off of selling books that are all about pursuing your dreams, and then people spend all this money going to like
right
Tony Robbins's talks or something,
right,
you know.
Right.
It's a huge industry.
It is a huge industry.
And there's actually an article that Jesse and I were passing among each other that's in the New York Magazine
right
this month that I'll send to you guys, but it's critiquing, I forget the author now.
It's critiquing the self-help movement.
You know what's funny? Is sometimes
or,
when I see those articles, I just think of like Republicans in Congress. You know, it's just like, we don't have the answers, but your answer is stupid.
Well, so it's the self and self-help, and it was in, we'll put a link up on this, but it's from January 6th in the New York Magazine, and Catherine Schultz wrote it. And she basically talked about sort of like the history of, you know, defining the self in Western culture. And so to say, like, how do you help the self when we don't really even talk about what the self is? And she talked about her own depression and how she, you know, what it was that led her out of her depression. You know, she tried many things, and so she attributed many possible, you know, whatever, quote-unquote, cures. So one of them, like, running or being, and she said probably therapy. Was what it was, but that's you know, that there's this curious thing where, you know, if it worked, there wouldn't be so many self-help books, right? That there would just be a few, and they would just work.
Right.
But we don't really have a manual for happiness at some level, which we are all seeking at some level, or, you know, not all of us maybe, you know, we talk. I mean, it's, you know, the pursuit of happiness, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness is sort of the basic tenets of American psychology, collective cultural psychology, and so to like at the one, it's just curious to me that on the one hand we all aspire to this, and on the other hand we sort of poo-poo the pursuit of it in any kind of real way, mm-hmm. you know, is a curious mm-hmm. hypocrisy, I guess, or internal mm-hmm. conflict maybe. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, or like it's not enough to say like I made this. I just try to make things that make me happy, mm-hmm. and hope that someone else gets something out of it.
Right.
You know, like maybe that's not enough, or it's narcissistic. Like I was sort
but
of
just
thinking,
to even mention, say, you said narcissistic, but to even think yeah. that's self-indulgent is mm-hmm. sort of like flies in the face of the ultimate, our agreed upon ultimate goal of happiness.
Right.
Right?
Like as you were talking, I was sort of thinking like about audience and then the intention of a work being made. Like if it's self-reflective and you're in it, it's about you and it's about your depression, then people think it's like something
right self-indulgent
yeah or if it's removed and it just so happens that you were depressed, you know, mm-hmm. as a side, it's almost like an added sort of bonus mm-hmm. information,
right.
Like you get in, you know, I don't know, there's like this very
there's an intentionality there line. and maybe this is what you're talking about in terms of the earnestness and the trust between the viewer and the
mm-hmm.
The and the artist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Well, now I was thinking, like, your phrase, it's Ellen Greenspan's phrase about, like, rational exuberance and, like, just how you like, I think you like the music of that.
Well,
phrase.
And what would rational exuberance be?
Right, and the absurdity of it.
Oh,
but I was also thinking,
delightful.
But I was thinking, but it's like, there's kind of, you know, I think, again, just to talk about this notion of cool, which I think is related to the skepticism,
mm-hmm.
right? And like, just having the courage to like kind of not be cool, but, like, so that's kind of how I interpret like
mm-hmm.
irrational exuberance, mm-hmm. like, whatever, yeah. There's kind of like whatever, whether it's indie rock or like or grad
mm-hmm.
school.
I think
there's
a generational thing though, because I think people who are like a decade younger than us. They're not trying to be too cool for school.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
when they think
yeah.
something's awesome, they're just like, rad, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
they wouldn't say rad, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, people are way more verbal
mm-hmm.
About their enthusiasm, I think. Like,
yeah.
the Awesome Foundation and all these things. And then it's funny, because there's all this, like, optimistic stuff in the tech industry that
mm-hmm.
sometimes I'm like, That raises my eyebrows actually sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
When
what do you
like,
can you
sort
go
of
into
things?
That a little bit more?
I feel like TED Talks, right?
Oh yeah.
Right.
Are like so like this is really simple, brilliant idea that you can totally come away with, and
mm-hmm.
and then it's a little bit oversimplified.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like
mm-hmm.
the life hacking movement, and I mean I feel like, and so I mean I'm very interested in like what do you know Timothy Ferris, and he wrote like 4-hour work week for our body, for our chef.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. I mean, I find it really interesting. I think he draws a lot on sort of like happiness science and research.
Mm-hmm.
Does a lot of like, you know, rigorous testing among small groups of people, and then increases it to find out what, you know, theoretically, quote unquote, works for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And says, you know, you do these things, you know, he's prescriptive after in an interesting way to me. Meaning like it's not you know, I think if you look at certain kinds of self-help books or even, you know, getting things done, etc., you know, these sort of manuals on how to live a more effective life that, you know, they don't leave you with a lot of tools, it seems like. Or they leave you with certain kinds of tools but no foundation. And I feel like there's like more, you know, this idea of smiling
mm-hmm.
to hijack your
mm-hmm.
limbic system to change your emotions,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that research is pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more things like that you can add into your sort of arsenal of how you are
mm-hmm.
on a daily basis leads to positive changes in the trajectory that you're establishing yourself,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people like in the life hacking movement and specifically around, I'm also dubious of the TED Talks. I think that they have sort of jumped the shark
mm-hmm.
in terms of like what, you know, it's like
mm-hmm.
they seem to be confusing like causality in an interesting way.
Well, and it's all like the same tone.
But it's
right.
very, it's, they're curated and they're forced to follow a certain kind of what they call a successful
mm-hmm.
Presentation. And it's just sort of like eating the perfect hors d'oeuvre or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's an hors d'oeuvre. It's not a meal at some level. Mm-hmm. And so I'm dubious of them. I mean, I think that there are some really great ideas and people doing really wonderful things, but just distilled in this way that mm-hmm. is sort of like, I think, mm-hmm. too pretty.
Mm-hmm. I just want to back up to like the, yeah, like, you were making, because it's funny, Christine, a moment ago you were talking about like the Republican, like there are Republicans in Congress. Like, mm-hmm. I think there's a dimension to this, and maybe I got it from that self-help critique article, mm-hmm. but like if there's a political dimension to this, to me, there is almost like there's a dimension to sort of this kind of you know, positive thinking thing where that's like you take responsibility for your own happiness, mm-hmm. and like and getting back to, I think as far as if Silicon Valley sort of has a political ethos, to me it's like a libertarian ethos, mm-hmm. And like I kind of maybe lumps the TED Talks in with that stuff too, mm-hmm. and so like there is, I guess, like part the dimension of my personal skepticism of this stuff is that political dimension, that like it is incumbent upon each person to be happy, and it seems to be taking some onus off of society to create like the environment for people to be happy within. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm just wanted to mention that once passing. But I don't know if you have a reaction to that.
I think like Carol was mentioning stuff like mm-hmm. she had this slide at the beginning about like misconceptions about happiness and like mm-hmm. so like happiness people. The happy people don't make a ton of money, right? So that is, it's so like up to a certain, like you need income up to a certain point, but above that, it's like $75,000 a year or something. It's like very,
yeah, it's $75,000.
Is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like above that
that's
point.
That's the happiness special.
Well, it's like, oh, it's basically like once you have your,
once
like
all of your needs are met.
Needs are met. Right. Like you can still increase your happiness a little bit, maybe, like, by being a super rich person, but like it's basically going to be all the same. And like, and also she mentioned the hedonic treadmill, so like you'll basically adapt to whatever, so whether you have a yacht or a jet, like you'll basically be the same, like,
those are no longer satisfying, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, and Bill Cunningham shoots those fashion people in New York City often refuses, like for special projects that he did in the past, refuse payment because, you know, they'd send him checks for Details Magazine, he'd return them because he felt like money doesn't matter, it's the freedom to, if they give you money, they get to tell you what to do.
Right.
And the most valuable thing is
aesthetic.
Right. Well,
he's kind of a monk. Yeah.
Right. He yeah. Like he just has the blue coat. Yeah. And then Bye.
No, so I guess like what Christine's saying is sort of the Carol basically debunked the fact that, like, I mean, you have people who live in a democracy mm-hmm. are more happier than people who are living in impoverished dictatorships. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So, like, there is a certain amount where the government does play a really important role. And that was number one on her slide. I don't know if that was, like, numerically, like, the most important thing mm-hmm. or, like, you know, like, in terms of people's happiness or, like, the misconceptions of what people think of who is happy in the world.
And, maybe I should just mention, like, I think that 75K figure is just probably for Americans.
Yeah.
Like, the threshold is probably much lower in, like, I think I remember seeing some workshop where they were talking about people in India, and, like, the strata is different, but, like, you can not have a lot, you know? Like, you can live in a house that probably leaks, you know, in the roof, and, like, maybe not necessarily have indoor plumbing, but no, you do have indoor plumbing. But you know what I'm saying, like.
Right. Basically, what you're trying to say is like there's a base level
of
having certain needs met, like food, clothes, shelter for mm-hmm. yourself and your family, extended family, in order for you to even start to begin to feel mm-hmm. like happiness can enter. Like until you mm-hmm. have all those needs met, then like there's a baseline that you have to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That seems harsh to say, like people who don't have that baseline can't be happy. I think
it's more like
once you have like your chances for happiness mm-hmm. are better.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, then it's a. I mean, I guess this is something that I've been curious about in terms of the role of art in society. And there's been, you know, like a push to bring different people into museums, like of different socioeconomic mm-hmm. classes, right? Mm-hmm. Or putting art, you know, I know somebody who puts art into sort of impoverished neighborhoods.
Mm.
And I'm very dubious of some of that, because it's like, I, as an artist, want to think that art can do a lot of great things, but if you're hungry or homeless or what have you, then, like, how do you, I don't know, I'm dubious of, like, the ability to appreciate. And maybe that's, I don't want to, like, dismiss their individual experiences, but I think as a whole, I'm curious about it, that would I, as a, living in deprivation, essentially, not getting certain needs met, hunger, education, these things that we take for, I don't know if we take it for granted, but they're assured to us.
Yeah, but then you always hear about these stories, like, I mean, I don't know about this, I mean, I just feel like you hear about stories of, you know, people making artwork in concentration camps,
right,
or, like,
right.
you know, making gardens in concentration camps, or, like...
Although I have an argument about the concentration camp specific example,
right,
because
right.
it's like you come from one... Like, you've known something else, right? Like, you had it one time,
okay.
your needs met, and then
okay.
you were, like, put into this horrible
right.
situation.
Right.
So that
yeah.
you have this thing to... you have, like, these
right.
wells to draw on.
Right.
Although not to dismiss
no, yeah,
what
yeah.
you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Example.
Yeah.
But, like, so somebody, in an American, like, let's just say, like, an African-American living in poverty in a city, going to a museum, I don't know... I mean, I just, like, what's that experience like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a...
Well,
yeah,
for Kerry James Marshall, he's, like, super inspired.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, 12 years old, and
mm-hmm.
his school had a field trip, and
right.
then he was like, I'm going to have a painting in here one day.
Right.
And then he did, and he's
yeah.
like, oh, well, now I have to figure out what I'm going to do
mm-hmm.
with the rest of my life. And
that's
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess it's like, how do you get your needs met? Like, is there a baseline, or is there not? And maybe is it worth talking about more or not? I don't know. Yeah.
I think it's more in probability, and there's probably a lot of researchers who know better than
mm-hmm.
me about how this all works.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I do feel like I went to International Positive Psychology Association conference in 2011 with support from a really nice foundation called the Jerome Foundation, and I went to one conference where there is a researcher who was saying that Maslow's hierarchy of needs does not necessarily need to be fulfilled in that order that Maslow was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we are saying, like, what we're talking about now is saying
right.
that these basic needs have to be fulfilled
mm-hmm.
first, but
right.
that researcher was saying, like, actually it's probably like a concurrent thing where people can just
mm-hmm.
do different things at different times.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. That's interesting.
Well, I think, like, so we're talking right now, we're talking about, like, the material, you know, like a baseline material,
mm-hmm.
you know, need being met in order for the conditions to happiness to be met. And I think what Carol also addressed, maybe in that same slide, was like, again, a political dimension where, you know, people aren't going to feel happy if they're living in a totalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
But like that has to be another part of the,
mm-hmm.
of the puzzle there, is of people feeling a certain level of like personal freedom
mm-hmm.
in their lives. And, you know, which is, you know, just a wanting, you know, to live in a democratic environment, basically. And I was kind of linking that back to, because I was thinking a lot, just to bring it back to the 3 years of work,
mm-hmm.
like, there is this interest in materials among all three of you that
mm-hmm.
are, like, they're sort of, I mean, they're sort of democratic materials, right? Like, they're readily accessible. They're not fine art materials per se. Like, I think Christine, you maybe addressed that at some point, like your
mm-hmm.
choice in using materials. But I was thinking that they're like, I was making a connection between that. It's like sort of the, you know, like happiness is not privilege. It's democratic.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I just wonder if you know, one of you or all of you want to
yeah,
respond
totally.
To that thought. It seems really central to what you're doing.
Well, I talked a little bit about like decoration and how there is,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's a pretty basic human urge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is to make the space around you reflect you and your needs and
mm-hmm.
your comfort. And then I think about how art or objects and objects can be imbued with emotions or meanings or sentiment. And then, so I you know, use a lot of materials and forms like flags and ribbons and like a lot like the I'm using like sign material for the mega pennant piece. So those are all like common, accessible, recognizable, familiar. But the things that we are trying to get at are very elusive, and I kind of like that distance and that kind of aspiration of the material to try and convey that. And then, I mean, I also like, for me, there is a thing about, you know, about class a little bit, like, you know, who is to say that one person's, you know, like tacky rhinestone thing that makes them happy when they put it on is any less valuable or like aesthetically interesting than like somebody super nice pave like diamond brooch or whatever. Brooch. I don't even know how to say that.
We're being made fun of for pronouncing brooch.
No, I actually love that all of our work has kind of a really wonderful entry point for lots of different, you know, types of people who might enter the space. And I mean, that's something that I think about a lot, is wanting, you know, a spectrum of people to be able to come and look at the work and receive something from it. And I think, you know, the use of pillows or the use of cookies or the use of ribbon, like these are all things that people have experiences with already. And, but then there is like a really interesting space in between them. Like they're kind of weird neon lights, or the benches are different than, you know, what you know, normally would see in a park, or, so there's, you know, a different way to, a different possibility to, a way to engage with the objects or with the works. But yeah, I love that how accessible and open-ended they are at the same time, all of the works in the show.
I was struck by the relationship with color, and I thought it was really great actually that your paintings didn't have text, but that the way that the colors related to each other really made it feel like such a cohesive show.
That's funny.
And it sounds like it wasn't intentional in the.
I mean, that was. It's always something that I think about, you know, colors and space. But when I saw Christine's work, it wasn't like I took a picture and I was trying to match it, but I think it's sort of like you absorb it.
Right.
And so I painted the benches and then, you know, assembled them in San Francisco and then got them into the space. And it wasn't even until the pennant was hung that we realized sort of how matching it was.
Right,
and,
right.
And I mean, I think if that was intentional, it would be sort of grotesque.
Right.
Like, or something. It would be too forced. But
right.
Because it was
no, it felt very authentic. Like, that wasn't...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and I was thinking about material, what you were saying, and just thinking about, like your process as an artist, like having a constant sort of idea or theme or project, and just... really trying out new materials or different ways to say the same thing, I think is a little bit what happened with the show, is we had a theme and the work didn't really exist yet. So
right.
We were really working around that without trying to sort of stuff meaning into it. That I feel like maybe that's how a lot of like the variety turned out. So.
And I think too, like, as before the podcast, we were talking about like how long, like how we've been in residence here, and some of us have been like for less time and some for more. But I was thinking like actually probably a large part of that cohesiveness of the show and how like maybe like developed the ideas are and developed the like exhibition design is largely like having to do with the residency. Like, yeah.
For sure. For sure. There's no way. Being able to see the space and
have our conversations with each
person.
Over the period of months, not just like 4 weeks before the show.
I mean, the way that Donna organizes the show is actually a really different experience for me. She really kind of gave us permission to do whatever we wanted to do, and also encouraged us to work together. So, both of those two things, and you know, pretty much from A to Z, like to figure out where we wanted to place the work, what work we were going to include, or she actually had suggestions for the work that she wanted us to include, but everything else we kind of had to negotiate with each other or just work with one another and think through our ideas with each other, which I think is what made it cohesive feeling.
You know, one thing that struck me, I don't know, so the idea of like an inner critic, I think maybe Carol was talking about that.
Talking about self-compassion.
So self-compassion, right, and then we can forgive each other, but we have a hard time forgiving ourselves. Mm-hmm. So when you're, and maybe Christine, especially for you, I have this question, just from what I've seen you posted on the SF MoMA blog and, you know, the various I don't know how you call it, like information aggregation drawings. I don't know what you call
positive
it.
Positive signs.
Positive signs, there we go. Do you worry about how they're going to be perceived by the sort of like the community, art community at large? And then, do you worry, like, do you have a critical voice or an idea of what their critical voice might be? And then how do you wrestle with that?
No, I don't worry about it.
You don't worry about it. Great.
I mean, if I have anxiety about it, it's like people will think they're not good drawings or like, you know, it's the normal stuff. It's
so
not
you don't worry about
like,
the content as much as you worry about the way they're executed?
Or, no, it's just like, you know, like when you put any work out, you know, it's kind of the general, like, oh, people don't think this is stupid.
Right.
Blah, blah. It's not anything particular to that content. That content, I actually felt like it was really good for SF MoMA blog, because a lot of it had to do with creativity and dealing with rejection, which I feel like is, these are really good, like, strategies and tools for artists to use, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, so you don't have it. And can I ask the question of you two both? And then the follow-up question to that is, as working as a group in collaboration, sort of, did you reinvigorate each other or like reinforce each other in a really positive way? Or how did that come out?
Well, as far as like worrying, no, I don't think I don't worry about how other people, you know, besides the natural stuff, like Christine was talking about.
You're putting
something
out into the public.
I mean, there's always a little bit of vulnerability that exists within that.
Well, exactly that self-critical
But I think that the self-critical voice is the one that's saying, like, is telling you, but you're stupid and don't do it. But, like, but actually, the point that we're doing it is sort of like, well, no, we're not listening, or I'm not listening to that voice, because in fact I am doing this, and I am making this decision to do this, and I'm okay, actually, how people read it, if they read it ironically, or if they read it, you know, like, it brings them, like, some measure of, you know, feeling good about themselves, or maybe it, you know, stirs them up emotionally in a way that I wouldn't expect. So, I mean, I think just in the doing means that you know, that critical voice, we are being, you know, just in the act of creation, we are being always self-compassionate in the way, you know, as an artist, that's kind of part of it, I think, is being, allowing yourself to kind of go down those roads where you feel that urge to do that, and you know, the world is going to tell you enough things about what not to do or how not to do it. But I mean, I think as a creative person, that is what we have to do, is kind of listen to that instinct or listen to our intuition in terms of what we want
to
make.
One of the things you said, that you wanted to be open to the possibilities of these ideas was, I thought, I had a sort of an epiphany moment about, I used to think people who believed in God were weak, because they didn't have, like, the self-reliance to go forward. And someone said, you know, you should be open to the possibility that there is a God. And why would you be closed off to that? Didn't, you know. I thought, oh, well, that's a really... Yeah, you're right. That was a very narrow-minded way of being. And I should be open to this. So I like this idea that you'd be open to the possibility of an idea as just a way of being, and that your work would somehow promote that. I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah. Cool.
Sorry. In terms of like your own
inner critic?
Yeah.
Yeah. Constant.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not gonna lie. Totally constant, but I've come to a place where I've realized it just doesn't matter.
Right.
And that is just part of it. And again, I was kind of thinking, like you take time to propose these ideas that you hope will be accepted, and then they are, with like such enthusiasm, and then, you know, by Donna and Kelly, and then you have to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then all throughout that you're like, is it right, is it good? And I think if I made things and knew exactly what they would be and how I felt about them all the time, I wouldn't really learn much. But, you know, and then I think about like, this is all about happiness, and you look back on happier times, and I wonder if at that, you look back on these times that were happy, I wonder if you knew then that they were happy, you know, like it's always like this kind of like a little bit of like a reflection and like our revealing and concealing and you know, but also, I had another thought that referred to Susan's thing, but now I can't remember. Anyways.
Can I ask you a question then about the, you know, preparing food at an opening?
Mm-hmm.
It's a curious strategy for engagement or engaging with an audience, mm-hmm. but also, like, you talked a little bit about the selfish generosity of giving a gift.
Yeah, well, I experimented with, because I in school ended up taking cake decorating classes on the side, and ended up making, you know, because the techniques overlapped or materials, and I ended up with a lot of extra cake and would bring it to my critiques, and I loved the response. You know, it's like, here's some cake, now let's talk about my paintings, and like, everyone, oh, cake, and then it was gone. and it got to a point where I was, it was always there, and then my main advisor said, like, you have to pick one. Because the cake is making the painting look sweet, or, you know, like, pick one. Or you make cakes and it's like a serious kind of fuck you to painting kind of thing. And he made a sign to go around my neck that said no more cakes, and I made all the cakes I could, like, the night of that night, and served them the next day until they were gone. And so it lasted for like a week, and I just realized it wasn't even about really the food or dessert, it was just about the response that I was interested by. And I probably a good experiment for me is to try no color and try no dessert, you know, try not to feed people and just see mm-hmm. what else happens by mm-hmm. simplifying it. And but so far it's I guess just given me a lot too, so but it's funny that you mentioned Tim Ferriss, because I listened to the City Arts and Lectures with him being interviewed as I was making the cookies for the installation last night by myself, which took me, like, you know, longer always than it does. And he was just, you know, I was just thinking what he would think of what I was doing then. And he would have sort of a lot to say. And
what do you think he would say?
Well, I had a lot of reaction to what he was saying. I felt like, what kind of joy is it to just do something, to get really good at it, and then say that you did it, and then move on to the next thing? Like, I just feel like that's a flimsy sort of experience.
Right.
Or like very strategic, I don't know. So
my take on him is that he likes to crack the nut. He doesn't care about it. Once it's cracked, it doesn't matter so much to him. It's the act of understanding a system is what's interesting to him.
Yeah, he maybe.
And then it just happens that it leads to, you know, awards or accolades or whatever. But that really, he's just into understanding. He's just analytical and curious at a.
Mm-hmm. I could just see him kind of like rolling his eyes at me, but it also made me think of Richard Serra. I gave a talk, and he was having, you know, 10 assistants make his oil stick paintings, like.
Mm-hmm.
Like there forever, and then he realized that he could just like get rid of like half of them and melt down all of the oil sticks into a loaf pan and then do it himself. And, you know, it's like also a little bit like Tim Ferriss mentality, I feel like. It's like, who need, you know,
right.
I can just condense this into something I can do myself.
Mm-hmm.
So,
although actually, I would just not as a huge defender of Tim Ferriss, but I would say that really the foundation is that he wants people to be happy.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. I mean, it's not far from what you guys are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So
we should have invited him.
Yeah. We're two small potatoes. We only have 14 listeners.
Well.
Not after this one.
Yeah, after this one, we're going to be on the map.
Not sound
I was 17.
Yeah. Yeah. Download it too. So
what is it? Oh, two dropped off. 3-5 minutes
in. Right. Right on. Well, this was great. Unless you guys have anything you want to wrap up and say in the end? Anything unsaid that's going to burden you for the rest of the night?
Oh, yeah. You were saying about how we collaborated. And I thought, like, there couldn't be two nicer people to collaborate with. And, like, super talented and, like, really smart. And I'm like, I love that we have such different skill sets and, like, it all... Like, I mean, I really do think this show, like, there's, like, a harmony to it. Because a lot of people were asking me what my work was.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking it was Leah's work or Susan's work. And I think it was, it really is. You know, so thankful for the artist as well as to Montalvo for making it possible.
Same. Yeah, thanks.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Nice work.
Thanks, you guys.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, you guys.
I had something I wanted to say. I don't know, I wanted to say this almost during the talk, but just to give a little background of my my upbringing. Somebody mentioned like being in Belfast.
Right.
Oh.
And I was like, I wonder if that's an Irish thing, because like in my house growing up, I used to I like to sing about the Moona and the Juna and the spring. I like sing in the morning sometimes. When I was a kid, I would sing in the morning, and my father would say, it was a quote from like his aunt, I think. It was, sing before breakfast, cry before dinner. So I was being imprinted for disappointment.
Very
encouraged to be pessimistic from her.
Exactly. So we can blame your parents.
But then you can just wake up the next day and sing again.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's
sing
about...
in the morning now. I don't sing in the morning.
Do you cry before dinner?
Depends what you're having.
I cried before breakfast.
Yeah, you did.
It was at my therapist.
Well, just as like a last note, I remember what I was going to say in the talk when the woman was like, the first question, like, I need to tell you that, like, the colors on the bench didn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
I actually feel like, you know, when you're always telling yourself or there's that constant voice, I feel like I want to hear more of that all the time, because I realized then it was like, it doesn't matter. I mean, like, there's nothing I can do about that.
Right.
You know, it's out there now, and it's kind of like, once you make it, you have to kind of set it free.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was actually, like, really, like, great to have.
Yeah, can you describe that exchange again? Because I was a little confused.
Well, she was just like, she went elaborately into kind of like, I'm from England, and then I went into a house, and it had a blue wall, and then it had a red thing, and then, you know, and then it's like, okay, you go into anyone's house, and it's maybe, you know, it depends on what their aesthetic is, but she felt it necessary to tell me that I chose colors that I liked and didn't like, and the combination of those for her didn't work.
Right.
So, you know, and it's like, it's just fine. I mean, but here the constant voice is like, what if someone doesn't like it? What if it doesn't work for someone? Really, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Well, so it's good to have somebody just straight up say something like that in the talk.
Yeah,
that
it doesn't hurt as bad as you think.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
But I guess she also was, didn't have a connection to me. So maybe.
Right.
That's kind of a hilarious thing to say.
But that sort of leads me to something like a question about the food. Like,
yeah.
It is a way of getting people, like, it's an immediate response, right? Either you can take this cake, which most people like sweets, and then they're gonna, like, there's an immediate gratification about it. So there's, like, an immediate, you know, at some level, if they finish their, you know, whereas if they're looking at your painting and they don't tell you, you don't know, right?
Yeah.
They I could love your painting and only spend 5 seconds in front of it, you know? Like, there's no way of judging my internal state, or I could hate it and stand in there for 30 minutes wondering why I hate it, you know? Like, you can't, there's no way to calibrate what, or assess what a viewer is doing, necessarily, unless they tell you. But when they're chowing down on your cake, or that's an immediate kind of connection, that's interesting.
Or if they don't eat it, there's something wrong with it, or,
Right. So,
yeah,
it's curious. Mm-hmm. Well.
Thank you.
That's
my elbow.
Don't you worry.
Damn. Polenta.
All right. Okay.
Thanks,
thanks for joining us for the aphorist.
Thanks.